True Crime Society podcast contains adult themes and violence and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. And if you'd like to skip the intro or move to any specific part of the podcast, please refer to the timestamps listed in the episode description. Thank you. What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the True Crime Society podcast with Stephanie and Olivia. It is July 21st, 2026, 9 p.m., super late here in New York for me. I'm just saying it's past my bedtime, but I am a dedicated podcaster. This is my job. So here I am showing up, even though actually today I got to sleep till 7, which is crazy, which is why baby Jack had a later bedtime tonight, which was kind of annoying. I do like a bit earlier bedtime, but I did get to sleep in. But there are days where he still throws in a 4:30 a.m., 5 a.m. wake up, which
what he feels like.
Is always a bummer. But I never know which I'm going to get. So that's why I'm always like, I got to go to sleep right now.
Yeah.
And no matter how much sleep I get, I'm still exhausted.
I feel like that's just forever.
I know, people keep saying that. I'm like, that doesn't make me feel better. What's up with me? What I've brought to briefly discuss this episode for my chat topic is Jack has gotten to the age where I'm legit worried that like someone's gonna call CPS on me, because now that he's more mobile and also still teething but with teeth, he just keeps fucking injuring himself. like yesterday. First, I talked about the biting. Like, he was biting me and my shoulders, which he's still doing, but getting a little better with. But now sometimes he'll, like, bite his own arm, and then he gave himself a bite mark. And I'm like, can you not? Like, you have a bruise now. You have a little bite mark on you. I don't want people to think I'm hurting you. And then I'm, like, on the phone with my mom yesterday, and he likes to pull up to stand on his, like, little bookshelf. It's a short, like, kind of pyramid angle bookshelf, if that's like the way to say it. So all the books are like kind of front facing. So we were sitting there. Well, I was sitting on the floor and holding him. He was like pulling up on it. And then he bends down and whacked his face on the corner of a book that was like off to the side that he like didn't see. So the book hit just like the bridge of his nose and then like where his eye is, like the orbital area. So he literally had a bruise on his nose and then like a black eye from where the book hit on the other side. I'm like, oh my God, please stop hurting yourself. It's so stressful now that he's just like moving around more. I'm like, is this normal? Or are you getting too beat up? Like, are people going to think I'm injuring my child?
I remember once when my youngest daughter was little, she used to love when my husband would like, it sounds really bad, but it was funny, where he'd like pick her up by her legs and like swing her a little bit. Like, so she was upside down. She'd think it was great. And then one day I'm like, oh my God, she's got all these bruises on. I'm going to have to take her to the doctor. What's going on? And I'm like, in my head, I'm thinking the worst. And the doctor goes, has like someone been holding her upside down? Because there's all these bruises on her leg where, you know, obviously, because yeah, I do not advocate this. I know people are going to say, like, you shouldn't dislocate a hip or whatever. But yeah, it was one of those things, just always covered in bruises. Wow.
But what's going on with you? Anything
not
exciting?
Not too much. No, one thing that is exciting is yesterday was the shortest day of the year here. So the days will start getting longer. I know we're not even a month into winter yet, but it gives me a bit of hope that we're nearly, you know, on the way out of winter, back into the warmth, into summer and all that.
I feel like winter just started there. Do you have like a short winter?
Well, I don't know. I guess it's exactly halfway through the year. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's true. It's only halfway.
Yeah. So no, like winter, all our seasons are exactly 3 months, from the first of the month to the end of the third month. So no, not a short winter, but like, I feel like by August, so we have June, July, winter, June, July, August is winter. I feel like by August it's warming up a little bit more. So yeah. Nearly there.
Yeah. Okay. So we have our list of Patreon subscribers. This week we have Allie, Cheyenne, and Carrie.
And just to make a little bit different for listener of the week last week, when I log on after the episode comes out, and I like, the, you know, obviously we get the most comments in the day or two after the episode comes out. So I logged on last week, the day after, to have a look. And there was a comment on there, but it was a 2024 episode. And the comment was actually from the person who we featured in the episode. So it's from Lacey Overby. I don't know if everyone remembers that story, but basically she likely made up a story that she was abducted. She tried to give a homeless man some food and he abducted her and basically tried to flee to Mexico. It was this whole wild, I feel like the title of the episode was Abduction or Hoax?
Yeah.
So she actually listened to the episode, even though it's a few years
old.
And
I definitely talked shit about her.
I feel like we always talk shit about her. Sorry, Lacey, if you're listening, because I know she's also in our Facebook group and has been. But she left a comment and she said, Lacey Overby, because her name, she's married now, so her name is different. But she wrote, Lacey Overby here, huge fan actually, came upon this by accident. I will say things are not what they seem and not on my part. So I did reply to her comment and said if she'd like to email us or send us an Instagram message to clear up anything, she's more than welcome. She hasn't done that yet. I don't know if she will ever do it because we've had threads on her case in our group and she's in there and she's never really cleared up whatever she wants to clear up.
So Lacey, if you're listening,
We're ready. We're here and waiting. It wasn't what I expected to see. People usually comment on the most recent episode, and all of a sudden that popped up. I'm like, wow, that's an interesting one. I feel like maybe one of the first times it's ever happened that someone who we have featured in an episode has commented on an episode. So, yeah.
Yes. Interesting times. Thank you to our listener of the week, Lacey, and thank you to our Patreon subscribers. Love you guys. You're all the best. Thank you for all the positivity and for subscribing. Besties.
Before we get into the episode, we're going to hear a word from our sponsor, DraftKings Casino. What do you get when you combine bingo-style bonuses and slots? Cashingo. DraftKings Casino is the exclusive place to play Cashingo slots. New casino players play $5 and get 1,000 flex spins. Claim 50 spins a day for 20 days on your choice of over 100 slots, including the exclusive Cashingo collection.
Download the DraftKings Casino app and sign up with code TCS to claim your flex spins and experience Cashingo, the feature you can't play anywhere else. The crown is yours. In partnership with DraftKings Casino, gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. 21 plus, physically present in Connecticut, Michigan, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, West Virginia only. Void in Ontario. Eligibility restrictions apply. Non-withdrawable spins issued as 50 spins per day over 20 days. Valid for select games only and expire each day after 24 hours. See terms at casino.draftkings.com/promos, ends July 22nd at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time. Okay, so we have a quick update. It's crazy because I feel like this should be a huge update, and the steam behind Rex Huerman and the Long Island serial killer case, I really feel like it just died because he took a plea deal, I guess. I don't know. It's the hype disappeared.
I don't want to say anticlimactic because there are obviously a lot of people involved and he has a lot of victims, but I feel like the end to this case is anticlimactic because I was interested to hear about the trial, what was going to come out at the trial, his motivations, his motives, all that, but then it just kind of ended.
I wonder, maybe we'll still get to hear about that because part of his plea deal was to talk to the FBI behavioral analysis unit or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know if they'll make it any public. Of it public, but I mean, I guess that's good, but yeah, it just feels like anticlimactic, I guess. And it does feel rude to say considering how many women died, but not that I feel like they didn't get justice because they did, but I still feel like there was not as much of a public evisceration of Rex Huerman as there would have been if there was a trial, you know?
I wonder how the families are feeling because I could see on one part they would be glad to maybe not have to relive it and hear the horrific details in a trial, but then maybe they want more answers. I don't know. I don't know how I would feel if I was one of the family members. Obviously, justice is served. He will never, ever be out of prison. But I wonder if they are happy that there's not a trial or if they want more information. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Because part of it's you want him to stand up there an answer for what he did, which I guess technically he did, but you want him to stand up there and say what he did and have to face what he did and have like the entire world like know what he did, even though we do to an extent, because like a lot of information did come out, but it just feels like it wasn't enough in a way for the horrible things that he did.
Yeah.
But anyways, so the update is Long Island architect Rex Heuermann, who was unmasked as the Long Island serial killer, he has been sentenced to life in prison without parole after confessing to the murders of 8 women. He pled guilty to the string of long unsolved murders known as the Gilgo Beach killings. He'll serve 3 life sentences for first-degree murder plus 25 years to life on 4 second-degree murder charges, all running consecutively. It's always interesting to me because I'm like, how do they decide like who gets what, you know? Yeah. Like which is which and which goes to which victim, you know?
Yeah.
He will be transferred to a state prison after having spent the past 3 years alone in a segregated cell at the Suffolk County Jail, reading crime novels and striking up a brief correspondence with the infamous Happy Face Killer. As part of his guilty plea, he agreed to cooperate with the FBI's behavioral analysis unit to help catch other serial killers. So it's he gets a job out of this?
Yeah. When he was sentenced, the judge asked him if he wanted to say anything. And basically, there's a clip on our Instagram if you want to see it. But I was just where he just speaks about how he's responsible for everything that has been said in the court today. And like, but it's, I found it interesting because when the judge says, did you want to say anything? And he just starts to talk, whereas the judge is like, stand up. The judge wasn't taking any of his bullshit. He just seems like.
Yeah, the judge was like, psh.
Yeah. I know Rex is resigned to the fact that he, you know, everyone knows he's guilty. He's never getting out. And I feel like his statement reflected that, but it was a week. Statement. It was like literally 30 seconds long, probably, if that. It was just
he basically just said like, yes, I did it, and the anything that I have to say won't mean anything to anyone.
So that's the end, I guess, the end of that case. I still feel like there might be more victims out there that we don't know of, whether or not they'll proceed with anything now that he's, you know, like, you have to, we've spoken before about the use of resources and he's never getting out, so is it worth the resources, obviously, to the families, yes, but I don't know. I'll be interested to see if any more deaths are attributed to him.
Yeah, I do want to, I feel like it won't, they won't make it public, but I would really be interested to see like what the FBI behavioral analysis unit finds out, because what he did really was horrible and depraved, and while being like a family man and all that, it'd be very interesting.
And also with his wife apparently having no knowledge of what was going on in their basement, in their house, in the kill room and all that type of stuff.
I
feel like often these FBI like profilers end up writing books about their experiences. So maybe I would definitely be interested to know more. It's such an interesting case and how he was able to go under the radar for so long and was only ended up being found out because of the pizza that he threw away.
Pizza.
It's really a case. I would love to know more about his motives. You know, he just did it for the thrill. Like, what? There must have been more going on.
And like, was he always like this? Like, as a kid, did he have like these feelings, or did something happen to him that made him this way? Asa, not to go on and on about it, as we always do. Asa has since finally been like, I'm not supporting him now that he's admitted to it. I'm still on the outs with her, though. I know people are like, I feel bad for her. I did feel bad for her at the start. Then she like did all these crazy interviews and I didn't feel as bad for her anymore.
I feel bad for his children. Yeah. The kids I feel bad for. I know that his daughter has kind of, I think, disowned him now.
She was more likable is not the right word. She was more, had more like awareness than Asa ever did.
Yeah.
And was like more honest about the situation instead of trying to like be in a bubble. But yeah, that's that with that. So, all right. So today we're going to be talking about the horrible case of Rachel Nickell, which is the topic of a Netflix documentary that a lot of people have been watching. It's called The Murder of Rachel Nickell. I was just saying on Patreon that like this case is so horrible and the murderer is such a horrible, disgusting, not to say depraved again, but like literally depraved. You can't even call him a human being. He is one of the very few people where it's like you don't want to think about him when you're going to sleep at night because you'll be scared.
Yeah. I saw it like along those lines. I saw some the other day, like, and it was a bit overdramatic, but someone's like at 10 p.m. every night, that's when they start thinking about Brian Koberger and how what he did. Like, it's just, there are some people who are so evil and
that's the people who target depraved. Like strangers. It's so scary. Because it could be you. It could be anyone.
Yeah, exactly. And this really could have been anyone, this case.
Yeah, and especially this case is just, it's one of the ones where I'm just like, why do I have an interest in true crime? Because cases like this really make me, I wish I never heard about it, because especially since, not to get into it, but this guy seemed to target women with children who were vulnerable because they were also taking care of their children. And I'm like, that could be me. This is why I'm scared to like go out on the bike path. This is why I'm scared to like do anything alone with my baby, because I think of things like this. And even though it's very rare, it happens. So on a summer afternoon in 1992, Rachel Nickell, who was only 23 years old, was brutally murdered on Wimbledon Common in London, England. Her two-year-old son was the only witness and was found clinging to her body. This crime that shocked Britain sparked one of the most controversial investigations in modern history. As public pressure mounted, police became fixated on a suspect. Police became fixated on a suspect and launched an unprecedented undercover honey trap operation, only for the case to collapse spectacularly in court. The hunt for Rachel's killer exposed serious flaws in police methods, fueled years of media scrutiny, and ultimately led to a breakthrough that revealed a very different perpetrator, turning the Rachel Nickell case into a haunting story of tragedy, obsession, and justice delayed. Even just this one really gets me, because just the kids being so close to what happened, like her son basically, I mean, not basically, her son witnessing what happened to her, just makes me feel sick.
Brenda, can you help me? No, Mom. Don't make it. I'll just be her face up.
Alex, look at me. When you saw the bad man, was he in front of you like I am? Or was he on this side? Or was he on that side?
He was in front
of me. He was right in front of you.
Yeah.
Did Mommy see him?
I didn't see him.
No. Did you see him first?
Yeah, I
can't. Did he have a bag?
Yeah.
And did he open it, or was it already open?
Yeah,
he
opened
it. And what did he get out?
A knife.
What did he see?
Knocked me over.
He knocked you over?
Yeah.
What was the thing?
A knife. That's a
job. Did you see it?
Yeah, I saw a knife.
Did you see it all the time?
I saw it. Yeah, I saw it.
My son witnessed his mother's murder, but nobody could have possibly known how long it was going to take to find the person who did this.
So a little bit of background on Rachel. Rachel Jane Nickell was born on November 23rd, 1968, to Monica and Andrew Nickell. According to the Netflix documentary, when she was around 19 years old, she met Andre Hanscombe. Andre was a few years older than her, and they were besotted with each other.
So the Netflix documentary, if you want to look it up, is called The Murder of Rachel Nickell. I did watch it the other day. It's only like it's a one episode thing that's 90 minutes long. They do focus quite a lot on like their early life and Andre. They interview Andre and they end up interviewing Alex as well in the episode, who was the son who witnessed the murder. But Andre speaks about how basically they had kind of a once in a lifetime love. They, you know, they got pregnant quite early into their relationship. She was very young. Andre was a few years older than her. It is interesting. I do feel in the documentary they focus a lot on the failed parts of the investigation more so than what we will get into, as in who the actual perpetrator was. So it's an interesting watch. It's very, very sad because they have some footage from Alex when he was 2 and 3 years old and being interviewed about what happened to his mother. And the trailer shows part of that, which we'll put a clip in this episode anyway, but it is an interesting watch if you want to learn more about the case. It's just quite a high level, obviously one-off overview. There's just so much more to the case than what's in the documentary.
Yeah, I will say I did not watch it. I considered it and then I read the notes and it made me feel so sad that then I didn't want to watch it. So, So in 1989, the couple's first and only child, Alexander Louise Hanscombe, was born and his parents called him Alex. Andre said Alex was absolutely a really sweet little boy. There was a joy that was there.
And when they show the clips in the documentary too, he is so cute. He's beautiful, like just looks like the sweetest little thing. He was a gorgeous little boy.
The family lived in Southwest London with their dog, Molly. Andre worked as a motorcycle courier and Alex spent most of his time with Rachel. Rachel and Alex would often visit Wimbledon Common, which is a large open space in Wimbledon, Southwest London. The area of the space is around 460 hectares or 1,140 acres. On Wednesday, July 15th, 1992, Rachel and Alex visited the common with their dog, Molly. Rachel was brutally attacked and sexually assaulted. She was stabbed 49 times in the neck and torso, and she died at the scene. Her stab wounds were so ferocious that she was almost decapitated. Rachel's body was found later that day by a dog walker. Alex was said to be hugging his mother and clinging to her. He was physically unharmed. According to The Guardian, he had placed a tiny piece of paper on Rachel's forehead like a band-aid and was crying, "Get up, mommy."
So sad.
Makes me so sad. Rachel was said to have been found on her back in an unnatural position. Her hands were up towards her face, which indicated that she'd fought until her last breath. Alex was taken to the hospital and Andre was informed about what happened. When Andre arrived at the hospital, he was told by professionals to be honest with Alex about what happened. He was told to tell Alex from the start that Rachel was dead. Andre has said that Alex never once asked where Rachel was, which made him believe that he somewhat understood what happened. It really breaks my heart what Alex went through. Ugh.
Yeah, I feel like too, even like, I don't know, it's not the same, but even with animals, like people understand death like without knowing what it is. I feel like, you know, if you see a dead body, like even for Alex to be 2 years old, that's what I feel like his father was saying, that he saw the body and he knew that his mother wasn't coming back, which is why he never asked, like, where is she, what is going on. Sometimes you just inherently kind of understand what has happened to your family or your, you know, whatever the scenario is.
Maybe he just dissociated from it, like didn't even as like a little tiny kid, just he knew it was so horrible that his brain was trying to protect him from even thinking about it. In the coming months, Alex had several sessions with a child psychologist. She wrote down questions for Andre to ask Alex. Alex gave some answers, like the bad man appeared from behind, he possibly washed his hands in a stream, and he was wearing a belt over his shirt. But obviously, he wasn't able to provide much solid information because, one, I feel like he went through something very traumatic that, like I said, his brain is probably trying to protect him from remembering, and he's so little. And I think it's, like, I get why they're asking him these things, but I'm like, leave him alone.
Yeah, no.
It's like, how much information were they really expecting to get from him, you know?
Like, he's not going to say he's 6'2" or like whatever. Like, he can't give specifics. He could probably say, like, even when he specific was a bad man, he can't really.
A bad man with a knife, which they could tell without having to ask him because she was stabbed however many times.
I guess because there was just so little evidence left at the scene. Like, they really had nothing to go on and were just, I guess, grasping at straws that Alex would be able to tell them a little bit more.
It also makes me annoyed that they put him through this and then still kind of like botched the investigation so bad for so long.
Yeah.
So police asked Andre and Alex to return to Wimbledon Common to see if they could retrace the steps. So not only are they asking poor little Alex about this crime, they're like, let's bring him back to the scene and see what he remembers.
Yeah.
I feel like that is insane. I feel like today that would not happen. Andre agreed and they went to the area. Alex became very upset and began to scream and cry. The media had also been following the group at the common and they took photos of the incident. Media agencies posted identifiable photos of Alex's face and Andre began to fear for their safety. They ended up moving out of England to France for a period of time, which I totally understand because you're like, this killer is still out there and they know that they're now trying to use this little boy who saw the killer to identify him. Like, I would want to move away also.
And Andre does, like, they show the photo in the documentary and Andre does speak about it. He said basically that was the point. He realized that he needed to get out of there because, who knew if this man was going to come after them, because Alex was the only person who could maybe identify him at that point. So it would have been very scary just dealing with the death of your wife, becoming a single father, the trauma that Alex has gone through, and then having to leave the country. It would have just been so overwhelming.
Yeah. So due to the heinous nature of the crime and the fact that an innocent child had witnessed his mother's brutal murder and had been left begging for her to wake up, this case garnered a lot of media attention from day one. Officers of the Metropolitan Police were under a lot of pressure to find Rachel's killer, and they began a large-scale investigation. They questioned 32 men in connection with the case. Paul Brin, who is a criminal psychologist, was asked to create an offender profile of the killer. This was due to the lack of forensic evidence being left at the scene. Paul's profile determined that the killer likely lived close to Wimbledon Common, struggled with dating, and did not have many or any close friends or relationships. A sketch of a possible suspect was created after a witness saw a man leaving the area on the day of the murder. I wonder if that person did actually see the correct person in the end. Like, we don't really know. I guess he could kind of look like him, but
I've put the sketch on the blog if you want to check it out. But basically, it's just
he looks like a sim.
A shitty generic 90s. Yeah, like it could be a million men, really.
Yeah, there's really nothing like identifiable about it. After the sketch was released, a tip was phoned in saying that the sketch resembled a man named Colin Stagg, who was 29 years old. So, of course, just going right off of that, they were like, yes, this is our man.
Yeah, he does look the sketch, but then, so like I mentioned, so could any other guy walking down the street, really.
Yeah, it just seems crazy. Colin was a 29-year-old unemployed man who lived in Roehampton near Wimbledon Common. He regularly walked his dog in the area. He lived alone, had few close relationships, and was described as shy, eccentric, and introverted. He had interests in nature, bodybuilding, and Wicca, which is a pagan religion. When police searched his flat, they found satanic imagery, a sign that said Christians beware, as well as symbols drawn into the carpet and around a survival kit. So this is giving like satanic panic at this point.
Yeah, that's, I was just thinking that too. And they do focus a lot in the documentary about how Colin was creepy and probably a little bit vulgar in communications that he had with people. So like, I guess it's reasonable to assume he could have been involved, but they just went too far.
Yeah. So authorities became convinced that Colin was responsible for Rachel's murder. They designed a cover operation called Operation Edsel to see if they could get Colin to either eliminate or implicate himself in the crime. This operation would later be labeled as a honey trap. A female officer going by the name Lizzie James began contacting Colin. He had previously used Lonely Hearts columns in newspapers to try to meet women, and one of the women he had contacted got in touch with police about some creepy correspondence that she had had with Colin. Once police had this info, Lizzie posed as a friend of the woman. Over a five-month period, she attempted to get information from Colin. Imagine this being your job.
No. And they do show some of the like letters and things that he wrote. Like it is creepy, don't get me wrong. But imagine if this was your job for 5 months to communicate with this man and to try to get him to admit to something that he didn't do.
Yeah. She pretended to have a romantic interest in him, met up with him, spoke repeatedly over the phone, and exchanged letters containing sexual fantasies. During one meeting in a park, they spoke about Rachel's murder. In the documentary, Colin explains. He said, I'd never had a proper girlfriend up to the point of 29, so when I received a letter from Lizzie James, I just felt really happy that a woman had shown interest in me. I had low self-esteem before this all started, and this knocked me back further. Lizzie obtained Colin's confidence and trust. She drew out fantasies from him that Paul Brin said were violent. He never admitted to killing Rachel. During a taped conversation between him and Lizzie, she claimed to enjoy hurting people. He replied, please explain. As I live a quiet life, if I've disappointed you, please don't dump me. Nothing like this has happened to me before. She went on to say, if only you had done the Wimbledon Common murder, if only you had killed her, it would be all right. And he replied, I'm terribly sorry, but I haven't, which is just like crazy.
Yeah, he was so desperate for love and attention that, you know, but even then he still wasn't desperate enough to pretend that he did it. Yeah, you do feel bad for him, and they interview him in the documentary and things like that. He said basically it destroyed his whole life, which it absolutely would. But he was just lonely and vulnerable, and they tried as hard as
And he was kind of weird.
Yeah, he was. And I'm not – he was absolutely weird and eccentric and probably inappropriate.
But not a murderer.
No.
And now he has to be, like, embarrassed in the public eye and seen as a murderer.
Yeah.
So despite him still not admitting to murdering Rachel – police believe that his violent sexual fantasies and the fact that he had knives in his home were enough to implicate him in Rachel's murder. He was arrested on August 17th, 1993. And he was held in prison for over a year. Crazy.
Yeah.
Just as the trial was about to begin in September 1994, Mr. Justice Ognall ruled that police had shown excessive zeal and had tried to incriminate Colin by deceptive conduct of the grossest kind. Ognall excluded all the entrapment evidence that had been gathered by police on the grounds that information given by Colin did not match up with the circumstances given regarding Rachel's murder. The prosecution ended up withdrawing the case and Colin was acquitted and freed. So like Olivia was saying, he appears in the Netflix documentary and says that the allegations against him ruined his life for years.
It was interesting because just jumping ahead a bit, when they do arrest someone for the murder, which we'll get into, Colin speaks about finding out about that. And he says reporters came to his house and knocked on the door and they're like, have you heard that someone's been arrested? And he goes, can you go away? I'm watching the football and come back in like an hour or whatever. So he goes, by this point, it had overtaken his life for 15 years. And he's just like, I've had enough. So he's interviewed in there. It's interesting to hear his side of the story in the documentary. Yeah. So after Colin was acquitted, the case seemingly grew cold. In the early 2000s, they did start to make some advances in DNA technology, and this allowed evidence from Rachel's case to be retested and re-examined. Because you have to remember, this happened in the early 90s. I feel like things came leaps and bounds from that period onwards. So they were very limited with what they could do at the time. But thankfully, as time progressed, they were able to do some more testing. They began to compare Rachel's injuries to those suffered by victims in other attacks, and they also consulted forensic specialists about improvements in DNA matching. In July 2003, it was announced that after 18 months of DNA testing on Rachel's clothes, they had found a male DNA sample that did not match that of her husband or her son. The sample was said to be at the time to be insufficient to confirm an identity, but was enough to rule suspects out. Eventually, police did come up with a match to the DNA that was found on Rachel's body and her clothing. The DNA belonged to a man named Robert Napper. As some background into him, he was born in February 1966 and he grew up in Plumstead in London. As a child, he had a pretty brutal childhood. He was said to have witnessed attacks on his mother, Pauline, which were carried out by his father, Brian. His parents ended up divorcing, and Robert and his three siblings were placed in foster care and underwent psychiatric treatment. So that's how traumatized they were by whatever they had seen growing up amongst their parents. Robert appears to have suffered more than his siblings. He had to undergo 6 years of treatment in a hospital. He encountered more psychological trauma when he was assaulted by a family friend at the age of 12. Pauline, his mother, said that after this, Robert became introverted, obsessively tidy and reclusive. He would only come out of his room to bully his siblings and to spy on his sister while she was getting changed. So red flags right from the start with this kid. You know, obviously he had a shitty childhood, but there's a lot going on and so many red flags that were missed. Robert's first criminal offence was recorded in 1986. He was fined and given a conditional discharge after being found in possession of an air gun. Not long after this, Robert confessed to his mother that he had raped a woman on Plumstead Common. She called police and they said they could find no evidence that such a crime had ever occurred and they dismissed her information. Despite this, there was a crime that matched what Robin had told his mother about. 8 weeks earlier, a mother reported to police that she'd been raped in her home in front of her children. The suspect had entered through a rear door of the property, masked and armed with a Stanley knife. This woman's house backed onto the Plumstead Common. Police took DNA from the woman, and had they bothered to investigate Pauline's claim, maybe something would have happened and Robert would have been arrested at this point. But this is just the first in a series of cracks that he fell through for years and years.
I was just going to say, it's crazy because, like, as you go on, it seems like there's literally neon signs pointing at Robert Napper. And the police are like, who? Like, yeah. They're just looking the other way. And there are signs pointing directly at this guy, and they're not seeing it at all.
So Pauline ended up cutting off all contact with Robert. Robert went on a horrific rampage of rape and murder in the early 1990s. We're going to run chronologically through what we know about his crimes. He's suspected of being a serial rapist known as the Green Chain Rapist. It's believed that he carried out at least 70 savage attacks across a four-year crime spree.
That's crazy.
Possible victims of Robert's have come forward. A woman claimed that in May of 1992, she was out for a walk with her daughter in the pram. Robert grabbed her from behind with force, placed a ligature around her neck, and she was pulled to the ground. This woman said that she was stripped, raped, and battered about the head for several minutes in front of her child. She said that she was left looking like a bloody rag doll. I asked him not to kill me. He didn't stop hitting me. He put a rope around my neck and kept bashing me on the head. So it's thought that this woman was the first victim in this green chain string of attacks. And this is,
it just
again,
makes me sick because it's like, not only, I can imagine like being one attacked like this and fearing for your life and trying to like protect yourself, but also having your small child there that you're like so afraid that this person is going to harm them that you also want to protect. This guy is just, I don't even have the words for it, but it really just makes me feel sick and upset to know that people like this guy exist.
So a few days later, another member of the public called police to say that they actually named him Bob Napper, looked like the rapist. Officers went to his flat and asked him to go to the police station and give a blood sample. Robert didn't go and no one followed up.
So
a few
crazy.
Weeks later, he was eliminated from the investigation because the rapist had been estimated as being 5'7" tall and Robert was 6'2". So just horrible, horrible police work.
Yeah.
In October of 1992, Robert became the subject of police attention again. He was arrested over suggestions that he had been stalking a civilian employee at a local police station. Authorities searched his apartment. They found a pistol, 244 rounds of ammunition, two knives, a crossbow, and six crossbow bolts. They also found pocket diaries, hand-drawn maps, notes written on the borders of newspapers, and a London A to Z. So I don't know if you remember those, but they were basically in the 90s. It was kind of a paperback book of street maps that people used before they had GPS and navigation apps. Robert had made notes that mentioned ways to restrain someone, including the phrase cling film on the legs. Another note named particular streets and gave map references for them in the A to Z. Pages had been marked with black dots highlighting certain areas, and other locations were marked with dashes. They were concentrated in the areas of Plumstead and Woolwich in southeast London. Robert kept diaries where he wrote vulgar things about women. He called one woman a sodden, filthy bitch. And in one of the A to Z's was a fitness card for a young blonde woman from Eltham, and it was placed in the page corresponding to her home address. So this kind of indicates that he was stalking these women. He had her business card, knew where she lived, and had placed it in the book of maps, which is just creepy.
It's crazy how like this guy had so much built up against him over the years that is clearly like red flag after red flag after red flag. But then with Colin, they're like, well, he's kind of weird and like there's some Satan stuff. So let's figure out how to trick him into confessing.
So Robert would end up pleading guilty to possessing a firearm and ammunition. In court, references were made to his disturbed mental state, and a psychiatric report was produced saying that he was, quote, without doubt an immediate threat to himself in the public. Despite all of this, he spent 8 weeks in custody. No further investigation were carried out on the things found in his apartment. So again, just double standards. Like, I know Colin apparently had this creepy stuff in his apartment. So does Robert, but nothing is happening to Robert. In April of 1993, Robert's fingerprints were found on a tin box that had been buried on a common. There was a handgun inside the box. Robert was never questioned this despite his fingerprints being found. In July of 1993, Robert's name was logged on a report after he had been reported as spying on a woman in her flat. A man had spotted Robert while he was spying and followed Robert back to his home. Police went to question him yet again. The officer's notes read, "Subject, strange, abnormal. Should be considered as a possible rapist, indecency type suspect." So
I feel like at this point, they could have literally seen him raping and murdering someone and they would have been like, who could have done this?
Yeah. So Rachel was killed in July of 1993. Robert committed more murders in November of 1993, which was months after Rachel died. He murdered single mother Samantha Bissett and her daughter Jasmine, who was 4, in their home in Plumstead in London. Both were brutally assaulted before they were murdered. Police have said that he used to watch Samantha and her boyfriend making love in the lounge room of the house. Robert went to the home on November 3rd of 1993 when Samantha's boyfriend was at work. He knocked on the door, and when she opened it, he began his attack immediately. He stabbed her with such ferocity that her spinal cord was almost severed. He stabbed her more than 70 times. This is just horrible, but he raped and suffocated the child upstairs, leaving her lying on her bed as if she was asleep. So he then went back down to Samantha. He propped her body against the sofa in the position in which he had seen her making love to her boyfriend. With his 7-inch knife, he sliced her torso open, pulling her ribcage apart as if to display her, and he removed part of her womb as a trophy. So Robert was convicted of the murders of Samantha and Jasmine in 1995. So 2 years after that happened, he was convicted of those murders. By that point, he still had not been associated with Rachel. By 2006, Robert was interviewed by authorities for over 2 days at Broadmoor, which was where he was being held. That's a high security psychiatric hospital in Berkshire in England. By that time, Robert was 40 and he had been diagnosed with terminology at that time as having paranoid schizophrenia and Asperger's, and he'd been in Broadmoor for over 10 years. On November 28th, 2007, Robert was charged with Rachel Nicole's murder. After Robert was identified as the likely perpetrator in the case, Paul Britton spoke out. He was the man that we spoke about earlier who had given the criminal profile. He had also been brought on at an early stage to advise on the Green Chain rapes. He said he gave police at the time 3 tips which would have led to the offender, and they were that the attacker would already be on their records for minor offences, he would have been noticed by neighbours, and his suspicious behaviour would have been mentioned at local police briefings. So all of those were true. The neighbours had specifically reported Bob Napper looks like the rapist. He had all these minor offences. So all of Paul Britton's kind of profiling was correct. He went on to say basically he didn't understand why these tips weren't acted on at the time. He said, to this day, I do not understand why this did not happen. We were looking at an escalating offender. My advice was to look at the case from a local level. He also spoke at that time about his thoughts on the Colin Stagg honey trap investigation. There was some questioning as to if Paul had been behind the idea of sending the letters and if he'd drafted some of the letters. He said that the plan had never been his idea and that he had never written the Lizzie James letters. He said, not only did I not write them, but I did not see them until they had been sent. It was never my notional suggestion that it would be a good idea to write the letters. My first question was, is this legal? What the police said echoes forever. Please don't concern yourself with legal issues, he was told. He went on to say the case was at the very top of the then Attorney General's watch list. The highest legal authorities in the land were involved. One of the myths that has been allowed to perpetuate is that the police were a bunch of mavericks. They were fully monitored at higher levels. So, you know, the police are like, there's these arguments that the police kind of went rogue, but he is saying that everyone knew the tactics that they were using and they were all kind of in agreement that that was how they should proceed. So Professor Lawrence Allison, who's the chair of forensic psychology at Liverpool University, and he also wrote a book on Robert, told The Guardian about these crimes. He said, frenzied random motiveless knife attacks on women are rare. Even more unusual are frenzied random knife attacks on women with their young children present. Here was Britton. So he's placing some blame on Paul Britton for not noticing more about the connection between these cases. He said, here was Britton with two of them under his nose and no one noticed. So there's a lot of back and forth.
Finger pointing.
Yeah, blame and victim, you know. Yeah, there's a lot of that going on still to this day. And I feel like even with the documentary, it will happen again because there were so many failures, but a lot of back and forth and who's to blame is what people are asking. So on January 24th of 2008, Robert pled not guilty to Rachel's murder. His trial started in November of that year, and on December 18th of 2008, he ended up pleading guilty to Rachel's manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility. Mr. Justice Griffith Williams said that Robert would be detained indefinitely at Broadmoor because he was a very dangerous man. It's unlikely he will ever be released, which I would think surely he will never, given the depravity of what he's done. I don't think he would ever be released, surely not.
No, that would be ridiculous.
So in terms of what happened with Andre and Alex, as mentioned, they left for France, England for France for a period of time before moving to Spain. Alex left school at age 16 to become a car mechanic. Since then, he's explored many career paths, including being a session musician. He's a trained hypnotherapist, and he's also trained in graphology, which is the analysis of handwriting for psychological purposes. He spent time in India and he studied to be a yoga teacher. So I do find it interesting. It seems like maybe he's searching for something like, I don't even know. You know, obviously I've spoken about the trauma that he would have endured seeing that, even if it's subconsciously, that he might not remember everything. It's just horrible. Andre has spoken about the anger that Alex experienced as he did grow up. He said, in the preteen years, there was an anger and the anger was quite rightly directed towards me. He did get into trouble with the authorities, just small stuff, but the police were on the doorstep of occasion. Alex has explained where some of the anger came from. He said, the thing that was most distressing for me was to be taken back to the day repeatedly and suggestions given about how I should feel about it, and I guess I carried that with me somewhat. He said that he did take out a lot of his anger on his father because he did not have the same respect and the same trust for him that he once had. He went on to say the fundamental point was that he was the protector of the family as the father and unfortunately had allowed this to happen to us. So in my teenage years, we had a lot of conflict. So in the documentary, Andre does speak a lot about basically how he didn't really know what to do. He was advised by these child psychologists and kind of went along with what he thought was expert opinions. And it does sound like he has regrets about how they handled it. And I feel like absolutely it would be handled so differently today if it happened again.
Yeah, I feel bad for him too, obviously. Like, he went through something super traumatic and now he's just trying to like do what all these professionals are telling him is the right thing to do. And
yeah,
it has to be scary. And you, like, how do you even know where to begin? So he trusted these people and unfortunately probably further traumatized Alex a bit, but I feel like you can't really blame him. He was doing his best.
And also, like, I think we mentioned that he was a motorcycle courier, so this is absolutely not his fault. Like, I wouldn't know what to do if that happened to me and my child. Like, children now, I would have no idea. So you have to at some point trust the experts. And I just feel like maybe it was a kind of an unprecedented case, and
I was gonna say, it doesn't happen often.
People thought they were doing the right thing. I don't know. So in 2014, Alex and Andre worked on a series of children's books titled The Adventures of Little Louis, which they say helped them both with their recovery. Alex wrote a memoir in 2017 titled Letting Go, A True Story of Murder, Loss and Survival. So Alex is now 36 years old and he lives in Barcelona in Spain. He said that he tries to live every day with the same belief in the infinity of the spirit that my mother would be with me always wherever I went. He now has, it seems like, quite a positive relationship with his father. And he said, my father sacrificed everything for me and for what he believed in without any guarantees of how it would turn out. He was brave enough to do what he felt was right in his heart, and I'm forever indebted to him for that. So they have released a joint statement, and it says, our life has been a battle. A journey has all been by the grace of God and a promise to go on together. And we feel incredibly blessed to be able to share our story in this way. We hope that audiences will be left with a testament to the tough battle of life we all face and to the power of faith, hope, love, and never giving up. So I thought that was a powerful statement. They had to wait so long for any justice for Rachel, working through all the issues that arose with Alex being the sole survivor and witness of the attack. But now they seem closer than ever, and hopefully they can get on with their lives with a little bit of peace now that, you know, justice has been served, the right person's in prison or incarcerated, hopefully for the rest of his life, and they can move on with healing.
Yeah, I'm glad that Alex and Andre were able to eventually come back together and have a strong relationship, especially with Alex witnessing what he did. Like, that could have really thrown him onto a horrible path, but it seems like he fought his way to being able to have as positive of a life that he could given the circumstances. So I guess that's like the happy ending ish. Like, it could have, he really could have fallen off and fallen into some bad things, but I'm glad it seems like he's doing okay. And same with the father.
Yeah, I did find it very interesting, the documentary. Andre is featured quite a lot. Like, he retells the story and everything that happened, and then Alex kind of comes in now at the end. They show clips from when Alex was a child and was being interviewed. So it is an interesting case to look at, just because, like, I had never heard of it until everyone, like, when we asked for suggestions, people like, cover the Rachel Nicole case. I'd never ever heard of it before. So it is just interesting in terms of the investigative tactics they used and the interview tactics they used with Alex. It's interesting to see how things have changed in like over a 30-year period.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems like a good example of like what not to do to kids who've witnessed murders and crimes now, because I didn't watch the documentary. I don't know if I'm going to, but I did see like the clips of him, just seeing him like so little in his chair being asked like these horrible questions about his mom being fucking brutally, excuse my language, but being brutally murdered and raped in front of him.
Andre,
and they're
does.
Just like asking him to relive it and asking him these questions of like, so did the bad man come from behind? Did the bad, and it's like specific details that they're like trying to get him to remember, and bringing him back to the place, like, it just breaks my heart for little Alex.
So they do show some clips in the documentary where they were with the child psychologist, but the clip, I guess, that's infamous in this case and is the one in the Netflix trailer is where they're sitting at a little child's table across from each other. Yeah. And Andre speaks about how this happened like months, might have even been like a year after the murders. And basically all of a sudden Alex started talking. So he got some paper and he set up the camera just to kind of record and try and see what Alex would say, and that's where he gave the most information about how he speaks about how Rachel didn't see the man and Alex saw the man first and things like that. So yeah. It's just like for that little boy to still be thinking about that a year or however long after the murders and to finally be able to open up about it, it's, yeah, just so sad.
Yeah, very heartbreaking. I mean, that's really it with the case. There's not much to discuss that we haven't discussed along the way of just how horrible it is. And it's really horrifying to think that people like Robert Knapper exist. I honestly, while you were reading your part, I like checked all my cameras to make sure they were on.
Yeah.
It is like, he was literally watching people through their windows. That's so scary.
And he really did seem to quite often target people with children as well, like Rachel, Samantha, and then also the woman who he raped. And well, like just maybe because he figured either that like maybe he was angry that they had a life he didn't have, maybe he thought they'd be more distracted with the child. I don't know. Horrible that he targeted women with children.
I saw people online point out how like he killed baby Jasmine. But not Alex, and yeah, it was because maybe he clearly hated women.
Yeah.
But it's, I think he also attacked women with children because like that's when you're kind of like the most vulnerable. You have so much going on. I think about this all the time when I'm trying to like get Jack in and out of the car of like, you're just like doing so many things at once. You're really not super, you're like overly aware of your surroundings, but at the same time not, because it's like, you're trying to get him out of the stroller, get him into the car seat, put him in the car safely, make sure that he's not too hot in the car, make sure your car's on, get the stuff that you bought at the store into the car while still like keeping an eye on him. And then you got to put the stroller into the car and you got to make sure you were parked in a good spot where you're not too close to other cars and like that no car's coming and none of your stuff's rolling away. And it's like, you're doing so many things that like, I could see why someone who is looking to attack someone would choose women with children, because yeah, you're constantly distracted because you're mostly focused on your kids and what you're doing and just trying to get everything situated. But yeah, I think about that a lot when I'm getting him in and out of the car, like doing things with him on my own, because it's scary to think that like someone could be preying upon you when you're so vulnerable like that. And especially because if you get attacked, like you want to just like protect your kid. Like you're willing to kind of like do anything. Like if some guy comes and attacks you when you're with your little baby child, I feel like you're more willing. If he says like do X, Y, and Z and I won't hurt your kid, you'll go along with it. Whereas maybe if the kid wasn't there, you would have fought.
Yeah.
So that's it for this episode. Like we said, there is the Netflix documentary if you want to watch it and learn some more about it and see some of the interviews. Again, this isn't sponsored by Netflix. We wish it was, but yeah, a lot of people were interested in the case, so we covered it. But everything will be on the blog at truecrimesocietyblog.com as always. Make sure you're following us on Instagram at True Crime Society. We're always posting updates. We've been posting more and more there. So if you're into true crime news and just seeing different stories, make sure you're following us there. If you want to see what we're up to, my account is stephsum_oliviastcsolivia. Make sure you check us out on Patreon. We do weekly bonus episodes, so you get 2 episodes a week, all ad-free. You also get earlier access to the main episode. Plus, we have lots of fun chats on there, all different things going on Patreon. So check us out there. If you can leave us some comments on Spotify, make sure you're following, subscribed, and sharing to your Instagram story is always a big help to us. We love seeing what everyone is doing while you're listening to the podcast. We love resharing what everyone is doing. So keep doing that. Keep posting and tagging us. But that is it. That is everything. Thank you guys so much for listening. Stay safe out there. Peace out.
See ya.